Gracie, and it was all painted all cool, you know, in that like kind of gang riding, you know, and that was my jacket, and I had some boots I'd found in a dumpster, army boots that didn't quite fit right, and I had about 7-8 warrants out for my arrest, mostly just minor traffic tickets and stuff I could never take care of, and then I had the felony thing, and I asked that guy for help, and you know, he sponsored me for a little while, and then he had to move away, and his suggestion was to ask God to put my next sponsor in my life. And I, you know, I didn't like to pray. I didn't know anything about that, but I did, and I found another sponsor, and his name was David J. And he started taking me through the steps. And, you know, we just took the steps as we came to him, one page at a time. I'd show up to his house, and we'd take the steps one page at a time. And when we got to whatever step it was, is we'd take it. And I learned a lot from that man. And I remember I was real anxious one time to turn myself in. I wanted to go to jail for all the warrants. I wanted to go take care of everything, because I was trying to get my license back, and they were holding my license for all these warrants, and he said something to me I still repeat to this day. He said, "Kirk, your life's none of your business anymore. Your life is to show up to Alcoholics Anonymous and help other people with their lives, and your higher power will take care of your life for you, so just don't worry about it." And so that's what I did, and I didn't have any clothes. I took a $7 an hour job at a toilet factory putting together toilet parts on an assembly line. I'm 30 years old, and I have to do like 300 parts an hour on this assembly line or you're fired, you know? And I just thought, if I get fired from this goddamn job, I'm gonna kill myself, because this is pathetic. And so I'm doing my job, and I'm showing up to AA, and I'm trying to help people, and they finally gave me a work uniform to wear, which was clothing. You know, I love clothing. I don't have any clothing. So I'm showing up to meetings, and people are going, "Hey, you got some clothing?" And I said, "Yeah, you know, it looks great. It's a little greasy, but yeah." And I remember when I finally saved up enough money to buy my first pair of shoes to get out of those army boots I'd found in the dumpster, I saved up $10. And because, you know, I was paying back the courts and all that stuff. And so I bought a pair of shoes at Payless. And they looked great. I just didn't know they were plastic. So they were plastic. So my feet sweating them all day. And I'm working, you know, 10, 12 hours a day. And I was so proud of those shoes, even though I was miserable wearing them, because I had bought them, you know, with my money. I didn't steal them. I didn't do anything. I didn't con anybody out of anything. I bought those shoes myself. And I just focused on coming to meetings to help other people with their problems. And just to give you a little history, I rode the bus. And I rode the bus about 2.5 hours to my job. I'd have to get up at about 4 a.m. to make it to an 8 o'clock job. And then I'd work all day. And then my boss would ask me to work overtime. And I would tell my boss, "Yes, I can work overtime, but I need a ride to my meeting because I'm going to miss the bus. So if you need me to work, you got to drive me." And I worked in Placentia, and my meeting was in Sunset Beach, so it wasn't a close drive. And he would say, "Yeah, okay, I'll drive you." So I had my boss driving me to AA. And that's when I hear newcomers say, like, "Oh, I can't do this," or "I can't do that," or you know, "It's too hard." It's like, no, it's not. If you're willing to go to any lengths and you're a yes for this program, I know a gal, Nika, in Long Beach, that really impressed me, because I was doing a lot of tough stuff. But Nika was a single mom with two little children, no car, went to work every day, showed up at meetings 7 days a week. And when I have a new guy tell me what he can and can't do in AA, I usually bring her name up. Not even mine, because they just think, you know, "Oh, Kirk, you're just crazy, like Delta Force AA guy. You're psycho with this shit," and whatever. And so I bring her name up. And thank God my sponsor gave me gave me the thing that I still pray to this day. He told me that the day I asked him for help, he said, Kirk, you're beyond human aid, and only a power greater than yourself can help you. And so you need to ask God to help you put this program first. And, because he knew a second wouldn't cut it. It's that cutting, baffling, powerful thing. A healthy second gets you nowhere in Alcoholics Anonymous. And then when he said that, he turned to the 10th step, and he shared with something. He shared something with me in the book at the time before I was even taking the steps. And in the 10th step, it says, by the time we've reached this step, we will have recovered. And I needed to hear that, because I needed to know there was freedom in this program. Because if I have to fight this thing, which I did for years, if I have to get up every day and want to drink but just not do it and sit on my hands and keep the damn plug in the jug and struggle and tell you guys how much I want to drink, damn it, and I'm just not gonna because I'm a tough guy, I'll fail that. I can't do that. I can't do that. I might do it for a year. I don't know. I really, I don't know how long I could do that. But I needed to know that there was freedom and dominion over this disease, keeping in mind I maintain and keep working on a few certain spiritual principles, that I could absolutely be a free man, as if I never drank before. And my sponsor used to say, and this would be him speaking, he used to say, I couldn't drink if I wanted to. And I'd say, why is that? And he said, because God's restored me to sanity, and you'd have to be insane to drink again. And so that's what happens, and that's the story you hear, is people, with time, they stop going to meetings, they stop helping others, the insanity returns, and they drink again, okay? Newcomer comes in, just doesn't do anything, just makes a lot of friends, plays some sober softball, hits some barbecues, and he drinks again, And it's not really shocking to see. And, but if you put this program first, I can promise you guys freedom. And there, I find that there's two types of alcoholics, mostly, that I see in AA, is people that are truly going for freedom in their life and people that are going for relief. And the problem with relief is, If you're in AA going for relief, that means you're always in some kind of pain that you need relief from. And that's no way to live. Why would I always want to be in some kind of pain where I'm always having to get relief from something? Give me freedom. I don't care how much I want to work. I don't care how much I have to work. I don't care how much sleep I lose. I don't care how many concerts I miss because I committed to a new guy that I take him through the book. I don't care. I'd prefer the freedom. I would prefer that peace that Alcoholics Anonymous gives us through these steps and through helping others. And so that's been my thing. I've been a freedom guy, and I make a lot of mistakes, and I actually took the steps again with another sponsor at 5 years sober, and I learned a lot, because he said, the only thing I know to do with you, Kirk, is take you through the steps again. I'm like, oh, no problem. Yeah, I'm freaking Mr. AA. I carry the AA flag wherever I go. I sponsor 10, 15 guys. Let's do this. I'm hardcore. Don't you know that? And he's like, okay, silly rabbit. We'll do these steps again, and we'll see. And I'm like, all right, let's do it. And so we started doing the steps again, and when I got to the fourth and fifth step, the wheels came off. The wheels came off completely. And what I realized is there were areas in my life where God did not exist at all, period, whatsoever. And it just so turns out those were all the areas that I had troubles in my life. Isn't that weird how that works? It's like, where God isn't, I struggle. Where God isn't, I suffer. And so so I was taking the steps again, and we took them just like we take them out of the book, and then he had some questions for me to answer. And one of them is, I am someone, and you're supposed to finish the sentence. And it's supposed to be a favorable thing, so a positive thing. So I just pray before I ever do step work, and I just go off whatever hits my mind first. So I wrote, I am someone who deserves love in my life, because that was an area I was suffering from, the lack of power. And then the next one said, no one should see me. And I wrote, no one should see me ever need them, ever. Because I'm like that. I protect myself. I'm scared of feeling pain and getting hurt. And I didn't even realize what I wrote at the time. When we were doing my fifth step, my sponsor read that to me and he says, do you know how completely opposite they are? How can you ever attract love of any form, of any kind in your life, any form of intimacy with your family, with another woman, with friends, if you're walking around this planet making everyone think you don't freaking need them? You need nobody. No one can get into your heart. And wow, my mind opened at 5 years sober, and I really realized what I was struggling with was so long I was wanting certain things to come into my life, but I was unwilling to be them first. And we learned that in AA. It's called contrary action, right? In order to have friends, you have to be a friend first. You have to go and find people and be a friend first in order to get a friend in your life. To have trust in your life, you have to be trustworthy. You can't be like wanting trustworthy friends and be stealing at your job, whether it's time, whatever it is, you know? And I want people to do what they say. Alcoholics never do what they say. Well, yeah. You know, and it's because a lot of us have no relationship to our word. We think our word is renegotiable. You know, hey, I'll meet you at the meeting tonight. 2 hours later, you get another call. Oh, I'd rather do that. I'm not showing up. You know, and so we have no integrity in those areas, and we learn that in AA. And I want love in my life. And so how do I get that? It's I have to be loving first. I have to open my heart, and my sponsor says it's living life with an open heart. And you know, it's probably the scariest thing I've ever done in my life is work these steps in an area that seemingly goes contrary to what a male is, what a man is. I think, you know, if someone talks shit, you punch them. You know what I mean? You punch them. That's what you do. Because you'll never hear the end of it if you don't. You know, and if you hurt yourself, you don't let anyone know you're hurt. You know, and you protect yourself from getting emotionally hurt at any cost because you're a man. You're tough, and you can't let anyone see anything else. You have to survive. And what I learned is I'd rather live than survive. I would rather be on the court playing the game than be surviving in the freaking stands watching it being played. And to do that, you gotta take a lot of risk. You gotta trust people just because. You gotta love people just because. You have to do what you say just because you said you'd do it. Do you know how much that sucks? That sucks. I remember one time I told a guy, okay, I'll meet you Wednesday night and we'll go through the book together. He's a newcomer. Wednesday night, we'll go through the book together. Great. Wednesday, 7:00. Next thing you know, I get a phone call. It's like synchronicity. I get a phone call. Hey, Kirk, I got 2 tickets to The Who. One's got your name on it. Great. I've never seen them. I've always wanted to see The Who. When is it? Wednesday night. I'm like, damn it. I want to renegotiate my word. But what I've learned is I say, you know what? I can't go. Because I've already told someone I was going to be somewhere else that night. And you know, it's those little things that we don't think have an impact on our spirit that really do. It's those little things. I mean, it's not the big things. It's not, you know, I had hepatitis C. That didn't come close to taking me out. You know, I got treatment. I went through the interferon, and actually I was one out of only 8 people in my doctor's entire career to clear the virus. So I'm clear. And it's not everyone's experience, but it was mine. I'm very grateful for that. But it wasn't the big things that almost took me out. It was the little things. You know, it was the renegotiating and not doing what I said. It was not being honest with the opposite sex. You know, it was not ever committing to one person. You know, I had a girlfriend once that I made stay my girlfriend. I mean, stay my date because I didn't want I didn't want to be her boyfriend because I wanted to make sure I could still date other people. But I knew, like, I couldn't tell her. Even though we were just dating, I couldn't tell her I was going to see other people because she'd break up with me. And my sponsor goes, well, that means your boyfriend, girlfriend. I said, no, I don't think you understand. Let me reiterate a little bit, and maybe you'll see my point. And so I went through it again, and he said, no, your boyfriend, girlfriend, and you're just trying not to do and be your word. And I remember I went to my sponsor once. I worked at a company. I sold golf clubs, and this is a brilliant case of alcoholism. I worked real hard. I sold a lot of golf clubs. So my dad's birthday came up, so I gave him some golf clubs for his birthday. I stole them. You know, I didn't pay for them. I mean, my head said, you know, you've made him so much money, these clubs are obviously yours. So I gave them to my dad, and my dad's face lit up. He was so happy to get those golf clubs. They're really great clubs. And about 3 months later, I'm talking to my sponsor, and it just dawned on me. I said, I think I stole some stuff from work. And the first thing out of his mouth was, what do you mean, think you stole? It's like being pregnant. You either did or didn't. You know, you're either pregnant or you're not. And I said, I guess I stole. And but what do I need to do? And he said, well, you need to go to your dad and tell him you stole the clubs and get the clubs back. And then take them back to the owner of the company and tell him you stole the clubs and give them back to him. I just, you know, can I just pay for the clubs? Can I just pay the guy for the clubs? Isn't that cool? And he said, absolutely not. And that was one of the hardest things I had to do because my dad was just starting to like me again, you know? And we were really getting along well. I didn't want to screw that up. And but I did. I'm willing to go to any length. So I walked up to my dad and I told him that I'd stole the clubs and that I needed them back. And he's like, oh, you don't need them back, do you? He didn't want them back from me. He wanted to keep them. And I'm like, no, Dad, give me back the clubs, you know? And so I took the clubs back and made my amends. And that's how I grow, is like doing those real difficult things. And, you know, it's hard to describe to you guys what my life's been like. I just had a birthday. My birthday was January 5th, 1998. And so January, I just turned 10. And thank you. Is my time up? I got 10 minutes? Billy had to shoot me with the Nerf gun to let me know I had 10 minutes. Kind of sorry I brought him with me tonight. But, you know, is there a way to take someone from an indigent, low-bottom, drug addict / alcoholic to where I'm at today? And just so you know where I'm at today, I have a couple companies. I've never been to college. I barely passed high school. And I'm doing some real estate investing, and I've traveled all over the place. I've been to Cambodia and the jungles in Cambodia, going through and looking at all the ancient temples out there and doing some really amazing stuff by myself, you know? And how do you get from where I was to where I'm at today? And when I was new, I used to think, oh, you must have done something special. You must have went back to school. You must have been smart to begin with. You know, I wasn't blessed with brains. And you must have had something going for you, or you're just a fucking trust fund baby and your parents pay for everything. And that's how I think. And so how do you get from here to there? And what I can tell you is it's just the process of these steps. And it's the process of opening your heart. And and you just got to be a yes for Alcoholics Anonymous. And I love that this is a young people's meeting. And I love to see all the young faces out here and everyone just on fire for this program. Because I remember when I was in AA, when I was younger, and I had a chance to get sober back then, I really had a shot. And I just thought, you know, when I went to relapse that time, my thinking was, you know, I'll be back. I'll make it back. And I didn't make it back for a little over 12 years on that relapse. Some people can come in and out and come in and out and come in and out, and it looks like it's hard on them, but it's actually good to see people coming back like that. And perpetual newcomers I love to see because I know they have a shot. But it's not always the case. And I love to see people sober with time and that are young people, because my experience, man, is I relapsed. I didn't make it back for 12 years. I had a lot of bitter experiences out there. And then coming into AA at 30, I mean, it's still pretty young, and I still feel pretty fortunate. But, you know, I just appreciate the youth in AA. And I see so much in you people. And it's just a reflection of myself. And I truly wish you guys all the ability to put this program first in your life. And hi to all the California people over here in the corner. I'll see you guys at some meetings here pretty soon, I'm sure. But anyways, thanks for letting me share. It's been an honor to be here.
We hope you enjoyed this recording. If you are interested in other speaker tapes or CDs from AA or Al-Anon, please contact us at Sound Solutions, toll-free 1-877-893-2777, or visit us on the web at soundsolutionsrecording.com. We are also available to cover your recording and sound system needs. Thank you for allowing us to be of service and carrying the message.
Hi, my name is Kirk, and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi, Kirk. We love you, Kirk. Lots and lots and lots. Woo!
Thank you. It's a very interesting greeting you guys have here. First off, I'd like to thank Teresa for asking me to come out and share with this group. It's an honor and a privilege. Thank you very much. And I'd like to point out a couple other two gentlemen here in the audience. Dale is the very first person in the first seat right here. He's known me since I got sober. And it wasn't a pretty picture back then, 10 years ago. And he's a dear friend of mine who's moved out here. And Billy, I've known in California. I used to sponsor him for a little bit. And then he's moved out here. And our friendship still remains just as strong as it's ever been, and we don't see each other that often. It's like we've never been apart. So I'm glad both of you guys could be here for this. I love you too. Okay, so I'd like to start off with is just sharing with you guys a little bit about bottoms. And apparently these guys are going to get a good view of the bottom today. But you know, a lot of people get confused with that because there's, you know, the high bottom drinker and the low bottom drinker. And, you know, the low bottoms don't necessarily feel like they belong, and the high bottoms don't feel like their story's quite good enough, or, you know, whatever it is that keeps us out of Alcoholics Anonymous. And, you know, your bottom is a spiritual bottom, and that's all it's ever been. It's always been a spiritual bottom. It has no bearing on how much you've lost or, you know, how hard you've had it, whether you lived on or off the streets, whether you're an English teacher or a criminal. It's the spiritual bottom that gets us here. And I experienced a lot of insanity because when I first got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I went through a treatment program. I was about 19, maybe 20 years old, and when I was in there, I'd hear a lot of people sharing about being really low bottom, gutter, you know, drunks and junkies and all this horrible stuff. And I'm like, who the hell are these people? You know, I don't belong with them. I don't belong with them at all. And then when I got sober finally at the age of 30, which was about, well, it was about a decade later, I had found my story, and I was a real, real low bottom, disgusting drunk. And all I heard then was people sharing about how, you know, they never lost their jobs and, you know, they did all these great things. And it just goes to show you, an alcoholic will hear anything they want to hear that will separate them from the group. And that's just, you know, that's why they say those words we hear so often. I'm looking at myself here in the monitor, kind of distracted me for a second. Motion, you know, but we'll hear whatever we want to hear to keep us apart from the group. And we hear those things in meetings that say alcoholism, cunning, baffling, powerful. And what happens is we hear those words so much they begin to lose meaning. But if you stay sober for long enough, you'll really see it. You know, you'll really see alcoholism, you know, take its toll. In my fellowship, we had 4 deaths last year and 1 murder at an AA meeting. And this is a serious disease and it's a serious illness. And to tell you a little bit about myself, I believe I was an alcoholic from the start. I was just a weird little kid, very dark-minded, never really fit in, and started drinking. I really felt in my community I started drinking late. I think I started drinking like 15, 16, and from where I grew up, that was a late drinker. I mean, you were really missing the boat back then. And so I started drinking, and within 2 weeks, I was shotgunning 12 packs in a park. You know, I remember my friend that introduced me to alcohol, who was not an alcoholic, said, "Holy Christ, I created a monster." And if he only had an idea of what was to come. But he never got to see what was to come because anyone that didn't drink the way I did, I promptly got rid of in my life. And as a matter of fact, no one really drank the way I did, so I just got rid of everybody. You know, and in Alcoholics Anonymous, we share about how we lost this and lost that and lost our job or lost our family. I gladly surrendered those things. Those things just got in the way. People who love me, go die. Get out of my way. You know, the job, man, you know, it's hard to drink on the job. And it's just kind of a hassle, and you got to hide it. So why have a job, you know? And I was really great at, like, the working a job for 2 weeks and then quitting and then sending my girlfriend to get the paycheck because I'm too embarrassed to show back up. And that's how I did my thing. And at 18... I auditioned for a band. I used to be a musician, and I auditioned for this band, and they were all these old guys. You know, they were like 29, and they were. It seemed real old to me at the time. Not so much anymore. It doesn't seem old at all. But they seemed like really old guys. And I auditioned for this band, and I made the cut. And these guys had a record out, and were doing some big things. And at that time, I don't know if I was an alcoholic. I had drank a lot. Alcoholically, I had done a lot of, you know, PCP and acid and cocaine and all that stuff, but I was still very much a fun-loving kind of guy. And one night they were smoking this stuff on foil, and you know, I'm an ignorant kid, and I said, hey, what's that? And they looked at me and they said, you know, it's hash, right? So I kind of knew what hash was. I'm like, hash is just like pot. It's like a real potent form of THC. So I can do that. Can I have some? And they said, sure, you can have some. And So I was smoking it with the band, and we were doing shows, and everything was great. And about 4 months into it, they told me I was actually smoking heroin, not hash. And I don't know what your guys' preconceived notions were of heroin, but I always thought you had to shoot it directly in your arm, and if you ever tried it once, you were a junkie. Which is actually what happened, but... but it didn't feel like that at the time, right? So I felt like, wow, this stuff's really great, and I'm in a band, and it's no big deal, and I kind of wish they would have told me to begin with, but they didn't, and we're good. And so I'm smoking that, and I'm playing in a band, and I'm living, you know, the dream, California dream, and just having a great time. And, you know, the lines we cross are, some of them are gray, some of them are very defined, and mine was very defined. I went from, you know, definitely an alcoholic drinker to that jumping off point virtually in one day. And what had happened is my best friend David got beat up. His dad used to beat on him all the time, and his dad beat him up and threw him through a glass table. And he's all cut up and bloodied, and he had been at a friend's house drinking himself into a stupor. And what we did to keep the band going is we sold drugs. So sold a lot of coke and a lot of weed, because studios are expensive, and why have a real job when you can do things illegally? So that's what we did. And my best friend David came over with my brother and another one of my friends to buy drugs off me that night. You know, I told David that he could spend the night at the house, and that, you know, it's you and me, David, till the wheels come off. You never have to see your father again. I got your back. I love you to death, and you will never step foot in that house again. And it was great, and we hugged, and we had one of those great drunken moments that drunken men have together. And he sat down on our couch, and we had this awesome huge pink prop couch we got from some studios in Hollywood. And he couldn't get up to go to the bathroom, so he wet himself on the couch, all over this just beautiful couch. And I understood, you know, I've wet myself a couple times. I totally get it. And he's my friend, but the guys in the band didn't quite take too kindly to him pissing all over the couch. So they said he had to leave. I tried to argue with them a little bit, but I'm just a teenage kid, and they were these adult rock star musicians, and I remember telling David that, you know, I'm going to send you home with my brother and my friend Danny, who he came with. I'm going to send you home. You're going to stay with my friend Danny, and on my way home tomorrow, I'll pick you up. On the way home that night, Danny rolled his truck, and David received some head injuries. And Danny had drugs on him, my drugs, so Danny ran from the scene. So it took the police like 45 minutes before they called for an ambulance, because they're, you know, fled from the scene type of situation, and David died on arrival to the hospital. And I can tell you guys now, like, you know, no one knew that would happen. There's no way to predict that stuff would happen, but I didn't have the tools for that back then. I didn't have the tools to know that I sold my friends a bunch of drugs, and I sent my friend David home with some guys, and now he's gone. And so my story really takes off from there, and a lot of people that hear me speak at meetings and everything, they think, wow, it's real hardcore. You really did all this stuff, you know, which is just weird to hear in the first place. But it's not that I did a lot of crazy, insane stuff. It's that I wanted to die, had like survivor's remorse at the time. So if I was going into an alley in Santa Ana with 20 gang members at 3 a.m, that's what I call a win-win situation, because they're either gonna kill me or they're gonna sell to me, and either way my head gets shut off. Either way, I do not have to think anymore. And that's just how it was. And what had happened is I started living on the streets, and I was an alcoholic and a junkie, and I would buy Lucky Lager by the case. And some of you may remember Lucky Lager, some of you may not, but they had those really great puzzles on the inside. And always took me longer than most to figure them out, I'm not sure. But I drink the Lucky Lager, and then I'd do the other drugs, and then I'd pass out in the hotel room, and did everything else an alcoholic and a drug addict does. I mean, I would, you know, break into homes, and I always justified it. You know, I was a really giving guy back then, because when I would break into your home, I wouldn't steal everything. I'd only steal what I needed to cop that day, you know, and maybe a little extra for tomorrow, but not everything. And I really thought I was doing you guys a favor, because if it was another criminal, he'd have wiped you out. And that's how I justified it. And so long story short, I was a drug addict for a very long time, and I never really went to jail. I went to jail 3 times really fast, and that was right when I got sober. But the whole time I was living on the streets, I never went to jail, which I think was actually worse for me, because, you know, jail, you get some meals, you get some decent sleep, and, you know, and I was just an alcoholic and a junkie, and I drank, you know, 12-pack to a case of beer a day. I was on methadone, I took Klonopin and Valium, and I shot heroin in my veins, and anything was good. Just shut my head off, and what had happened is, I'm 6'5", you know, and I got arrested, and I was about 120 pounds when I got arrested, and I was dying, and right when the drugs started to run out of me during the whole booking process, I collapsed, and they had to put me on IVs in the hospital and wheel me around in wheelchairs. And if you really want to get a guard angry, make him wheel a junkie around in a wheelchair. They don't really appreciate that very much. And so that's what they did, and then I got this 8-man cell, which, you know, oddly enough, to show you where my mind is, I'm like, ooh, an 8-man cell. I'm not in a dorm. This is kind of nice, you know, and you can see the TV through the bars and the little day rooms attached. It's like the Hilton to me, you know, and so I'm there, and they roll this other guy into our cell, and people are always coming in and out, right? So you just always want to get to know the guys that come in, because you don't know if they're out of their minds or not, you know? So it's always good to say, hey, you know, what's up? My name's Kirk. Who are you? And so I did, and I met this guy named Louie. He got rolled into the cell, and I said, hey, Louie, my name's Kirk. You know, possession of heroin charge. You're probably going to be here for a little while. Welcome to my 8-man cell, and I said, you know, Louie, what are you in here for? And he said that he had a brain tumor in his head that made him murder people, and I was really curious as to how he got in my cell, a murderer. I mean, I was on a possession charge, but he did nonetheless. And oddly enough, we both had the top bunks together. And so I'm giving him Snicker bars. I'm just hooking this guy up. I'm totally hooking Louie up. We're bros. And I'm even writing to his little girl, because I'm a pretty decent writer, and he'd have me write little poems and stuff to his little girl. And then he'd sign his name. And then one night, Louie comes right over my head. It's lights out, and his head is right above mine. And I was sleeping, and he goes, psst, Kirk, you know, hey, wake up. And I wake up, and I see Louie, and I say, yeah, Louie, what's going on? And he says, you know, if I try and murder you in your sleep, I don't mean it. I really kind of like you. And I just remember looking up to him saying, you know, thanks, Louie, I like you too. And then I remember praying. And I just remember praying and saying, God, if you get me out of this, I will never, ever drink and use again. And I got out. And within 24 hours, I was drinking and using. Because I'm not that bright. They describe alcoholic insanity as doing the same thing over and over again, expecting a different result. Not the same result. If you thought you were going to get the same result, you wouldn't do it. You know, oh, hey, I'm going to drink again. Now I'm going to be in prison. Great. No, I'd rather not. But we think, you know, okay, I'm going to drink again because jail was stressful. And I just need to take the edge off a bit. And I know I got a test in 3 weeks, so I'm just going to drink this one time. I'm just going to stop, and it's going to be great. And I'm going to test, and I'm going to get this little job, and maybe I'll shoot heroin once a month. And the head says, God, Kirk, that is fucking brilliant. That's amazing. You could do that. And so it says, yeah, well, let's do that. Of course, I'm brilliant, and I'm going to do that. And so I do it. And then next thing you know, how I got out of jail was I took a year and a half suspended sentence. And I'm sure some of you are familiar with that, where you plead guilty, they judge you, you're guilty, you're suspended sentence, one dirty test, and your ass is mine. And this time you get to move the tassel from the left to the right, because you're no longer going to county jail, you're going to prison, pal. And I said, great, where do I fucking sign? I'm signing this shit because I can stay clean. And I'm only going to drink once because jail was stressful. And I know I'm only going to drink once. And the next thing you know, my piss test comes up for my program I'm in. And I tested dirty for heroin, Klonopin, methadone, and cocaine. So I don't play around. You know, if you're going to give a dirty, you might as well just go all out. So I gave a dirty. That's actually what prompted me into Alcoholics Anonymous. And it wasn't to get a letter for the judge. I did that when I was a teenager. And it wasn't to get out of going to prison. I knew I was going to prison. I knew it. The threat of going to prison doesn't scare me. I get scared when I bought the ticket and boarded the train. You know what I mean? The train's left the building, now I'm a little scared, okay? And so I had an intuitive thought, and it's the only thing I can liken it to is, my head said, you know, when you get out of prison, you're going to say the same thing to yourself, and now you're going to be on parole, and you're never going to get out of this. It's just going to be a revolving door for you. So what I did is I started calling detoxes. And I didn't know at the time, I'm clearly an alcoholic, but I didn't know at the time that you had to say that to get into a detox. Because I was doing a lot of other things. So I'd call, you know, and I'd say, yeah, I'm a heroin addict. And they go, oh no, we're not letting you in detox. And I'm like, what? You know, I need help. Why won't you let me in? They're like, because all you fucking junkies go out the window. We have perfectly good doors. You can walk out whenever you want, but you always go out the freaking windows. We can't keep a screen on the place, and you're the most disappointing people we've ever run into. And I love you too. You know, I need help. So I called around detox after detox and I couldn't get in. And I called this one named Stanton Detox, which I'm sure Dale's familiar with. And Stanton Detox is a trailer. It's not like a building. It's a freaking trailer. And they give you a plastic bed, a toilet to puke in, and 3 meals a day if you can hold it down. And the junkies are dying and puking their guts out, and the tweakers are running around telling stories, eating 3-4 meals a fucking day, okay? They're just happy as they can be to be in detox. It's unbelievable. So that's the detox I went in. And there's visiting hours, and everyone's getting visited by, you know, their brother or their wife or their sister or their, you know, their son or whoever. And I had burned out every bridge. I know my parents still love me, but they didn't like me at all. And so I didn't have anyone visiting. There was a guy that came in, actually two guys, Pat and Rocky. They came into this detox, and you have to sign in. There's a sign-in sheet, and it says, who are you here to visit? And, you know, everywhere it says, I'm here to visit my daughter or my son or whatever, and they just wrote anyone. They're just there to visit anyone. And what I later found out is they were recovered members of Alcoholics Anonymous that was coming in to share a message with anyone that was willing to listen to them. And I just happened to be that anyone they ran into that day. And I was really sick, and I had been hearing some people at panels, like, you know, they had a lot of panels come in at Stanton Detox, and they were very much like, you're going to die, you know, don't you know you're dying? And I just remember thinking, shut up. Of course I'm dying. I'm 6'5". I'm 120 pounds. I have abscesses all over my body, mostly on my legs. I can barely walk. No shit, I'm dying. Tell me something I don't know, you know? And so that just didn't turn me on, was that like your dying speech. It's like, great, I'm dying, so what? What now? But Rocky came in, and he told me a funny story. He told me a story about how he'd take all his booze and all his drugs and everything, and he'd swear off forever, and he'd throw them down the sewer. And then at midnight, he'd be knee-deep in sewer mud, digging his shit out of the sewer. And I laughed. I laughed so hard because I did that 5 separate times on 5 separate occasions. I would always be going commando down in the sewer trying to find my stuff I had sworn off just, you know, a few hours ago. And so I laughed. And, you know, the guy knew a lot about the Big Book because it says in there that sometimes you just tell the guy a funny story. And it says it right in Working with Others. Sometimes you just tell him a funny story. And what I knew when he told me that story is he was just like me, because I had done exactly that. And I knew that he wasn't like me at all anymore, because he'd found a solution on how to live. And so I asked him to be my sponsor, and I still had the prison thing hanging over my head, and I was wearing some clothes I found in a dumpster in Westminster. You know, I had some really great winter wear for the season, you know, and I had this jacket a cholo gave me that had graffiti all on the inside that said, Joker loves trade.